May I please report? This case is about an attorney's fee award. The specific issue is the rate of attorney's fees that are to be awarded in contested cases brought under Chapter 536. I litigated the case for Mr. Springer based on his termination in 2005. We were successful in obtaining a decision from the board before which we had the hearing, and we made a request for attorney's fees, which was denied at that time because they said it was not a contested case. The case worked its way up to the Western District, worked its way back down to the board. We had a hearing in front of the board in which I testified and Roger Brown testified with respect to the availability of attorneys in mid-Missouri for this type of litigation and what the rate was that was necessary to obtain competent counsel. The board, however, decided to rule against us in that regard and awarded attorney's fees based on $75 per hour, believing that to be the statutory cap. We then appealed that to the Western District. They upheld, and now we're here. I do not believe that the legislature intended or said that the statutory cap was $75 per hour, even if you couldn't find an attorney qualified to take a case like that for anything like $75 an hour. And I do not believe that's what the statute says, and I do not believe that's what the legislature intended. The intent of the legislature has been spelled out by our case law, and it is that attorney's fees are to be awarded in order to allow claimants such as Mr. Springer to litigate their cases and hold state agencies responsible for unjustified action. Keep in mind, you only get an attorney fee award if you're a prevailing party and if the court determines that the state was not substantially justified in its position. Fairly high threshold. But if you make that finding, under the statute, the court is to, or the board, is to award attorney's fees. The statute says a reasonable attorney fee. It says it in section 085 and 087, it says it about 12 times, reasonable attorney fee. The exception is in 536.085.4, and it says that the exception is for attorney's fees. It also makes an exception for expert witness fees. Expert witness fees are defined by a very bright line test. That is, expert witnesses are, fees are awarded in contested cases based upon the maximum rate awarded, paid by the state for the same kind of expert witness. Very easy rule to apply. The legislature, however, I believe, made it more flexible on the attorney fee provision. And they said $75 unless a special factor such as the unavailability of qualified attorneys justifies a higher rate.
And in this case, it looked like that the board found, and I'll quote from the board's language, that Mr. Brown did not provide evidence for any other factor such as limited availability of qualified attorneys for this type of case. Judge Callahan found the statutory rate was appropriate. The Court of Appeals relied upon that. Sounds like you didn't meet that exception.
Well, in the brief I outlined in the record where Mr. Brown did testify that there were very few attorneys and it would be very unusual to find an attorney qualified to take this case. I testified also about the unavailability of other attorneys.
Was your testimony about the unavailability of attorneys who understood this area of law and could litigate it, or the unavailability of people who would take it for $75 within that subset?
Both.
Okay.
But the board didn't find it that way?
Disregarded.
Don't we have to defer to their findings?
But there wasn't any testimony again. There's no testimony refuting the point that you made, was there? There was no contested testimony that there were people available. Did they find any? The people, your opponent, come, it's adversary proceeding. They say, well, no, there's a lawyer here that will take the case.
They did not put on any evidence in that regard. They didn't even bring in the phone book, which in Jeff City phone book in 2008 had 36 pages of lawyers, none of them claiming to have the expertise to do this kind of case.
What was so special? What does the record show was specialized about the knowledge needed for this case?
The issue of whether it was or was not a contested case, it was a huge thing. And I fought that from the beginning, the inception of the case before the board. And they have taken this position for, I don't know, 30 or 40 years and gotten away with it that they don't even have
that
to
you weren't entitled to a hearing and so forth.
That is correct.
But now, back to my question about,
yes, ma'am.
Doesn't the court, don't we review the board's findings?
You do review the board's findings, and you give them discretion with respect to their findings. In fact, that is true. But when the record is replete with facts different than what the board found, and there is no evidence to the contrary by the board, I think those findings are arbitrary and capricious.
What's that mean, such as?
Such as.
Such as, are there some other such ases?
I think that there are. When I looked at the cases, I tried to figure that out too. If you look at Hutchings, which is the case I primarily rely on, an Eastern District case out of Missouri, they found two factors in that case with respect to the attorney involved, and they awarded an amount over $75 an hour. The first factor they found was that he was specialized in Medicaid law, and there weren't many attorneys out there who did that, and he was the only one that the client could find. The second factor they found that there was no attorney in St. Louis that would work for $75 an hour. There was a similar case, McMahon, Missouri case, Eastern District, where it found one special factor, and that was no attorney would work for $75 an hour. The only other case I could find is a federal case, Douglas, which said there were two factors. One was the specialty of the attorney. The other one was unavailability of any attorney to work for $75 an hour that's qualified for the case.
Can you address the U.S. Supreme Court case cited by the Court of Appeals, Pierce versus Underwood, which says the mere fact that $75 is less than the market rate does not make it a special factor, basically?
Justice Scalia, that language is cited in the Douglas case, which came out after Pierce. And Douglas said, based upon Pierce, we find there's two factors. One is the specialty of the attorney, and the other one is nobody will work for $75 an hour.
And that was a U.S. Supreme Court case also?
No, Douglas
okay.
is a...
It was a trial court case, right?
It is.
But if the legislature wanted to cut off any attorney's fees, they could have done as they did with, as the Congress did with the civil, with veterans cases. They limited the fee to $15, no exceptions. And so no one ever took a case to represent a veteran in any kind of veterans case. It was $15, the Civil War amount of money. No one's going to take it. If they didn't want you to have an exception to allow lawyers to have some flexibility, then they wouldn't have provided for it.
I think that's true. And in the Federal Act, I don't know if it's useful in analyzing this question, but after the Pierce decision, the legislature changed the Federal Administrative Act to provide for a cost of living increase, which is clearly a market.
And that brings me to another question I had, which is, assuming I were to agree that you have to look at the limited availability of attorneys willing to take the case at the $75 fee, the legislature clearly did not say you get paid market rate, which it did for other kinds of payments. Why are you assuming it's either $75 or market rate? Doesn't it say justifies a higher fee? Why is that higher fee? I mean, it may be you can't get anybody at $75, but at $125 you could, even though $175 is the market rate. I mean, isn't that a factual determination for the trial court of what higher fee is justified when you reach above that threshold where no one will take the case?
If
you said that was automatically market rate, in effect you're getting rid of the limit put in by the legislature and replacing it with market rate, because it's market rate will never be $75.
And I agree. It does appear that the statute is designed to direct the court to look at factors other than market factors.
Basically, the lowest rate you can get away with and still get competent attorneys to represent someone.
To me, that makes sense.
Yeah, is there anything in the record that indicates what your agreement with your client was on what your hourly rate would be or what your fees would be?
I'm sorry, ma'am, would you repeat
the question? Is there anything in the record that indicates what your agreement with your client was on your hourly rate?
I don't know that I put my fee agreement in the record. I put in my monthly billing statements, which he paid, with the actual amounts that I charged, with the hours and the rate. I started out in 2005 at $155 an hour. I'm now at $200, 5 years later.
But when they added the language of or higher, it's one thing to say there'll be a lawyers available. There could be 50 lawyers at Bryan Cave that have the ability or the skills to do the case, but are they going to do it if they're not getting a higher rate? When they put the higher rate in the statute, that implies some marketability or some sense of economic value. I'm sorry, Judge.
No, my question was, Judge Schiff mentioned trial court, but trial courts are trial judges are retreaded lawyers, and we impute to them some expertise on this issue of attorney's fees. But in this case, we're talking about this board, right?
Yes.
Are all members of this board attorneys?
None were attorneys.
Okay, so would that same type of deference be given to a group of people, none of which have any training to be lawyers or any expertise in the area of attorney's fees?
I would think not, but that is a conundrum that's built right into the procedures. Normally, these boards are not composed of people who are attorneys.
And so the issue is, do we defer to them like we naturally would a trial court? There's all sorts of cases that talk about the deference to be given to trial judges, and they're deemed experts on attorney's fees. But is there anything in the law that gives the same sort of deference to some board made up of non-attorneys?
I would say not. The only standard we have out there is the deference we give to the finder of fact in administrative proceedings.
I respect Judge Callahan, he's a superb judge and he's a superb U.S. attorney, his entire career was as a prosecutor. I don't know that he ever charged a fee to a client in his life.
But the board didn't make a finding on the amount of the fee. The board made a finding on the fact that there was no evidence presented by you as to the limited availability of qualified attorneys in the area. Mr. Brown testified as to the amounts, but there was no testimony as to that factor as spelled out in the statutory exception, and that's where the failure of evidence was.
Well, that was clearly my testimony. I was under oath and I testified.
So when we look at the record and look at the transcript, we might see otherwise?
Yes, ma'am, you will.
And Mr. Brown, too, testified that there weren't any attorneys who would take the case for $75. So it comes down to what is meant by and what the board meant and what the statute means by limited availability. Does it just mean qualifications and expertise, which your testimony addresses? Or does it also mean people who won't take it for that sum, which Mr. Brown's testimony addresses?
That is the problem, and it appears in Pierce also with the Justice Scalia wrestling with saying it isn't market factors, but then it comes back to market factors because, yeah.
Well, and wasn't the Court of Appeals decision based on the fact that if there is limited availability, but that applies in every single case, that can't be a special factor because it's a general circumstance that is applicable to every case?
Well, certainly, Justice Scalia certainly said that in his opinion, no doubt. And so he directed courts to specific things, not general market factors. Thank you.
May it please the court.
Mr. Bruce, how many, do you think there are many lawyers in the state of Missouri who know the difference between a contested and an uncontested case? I'm just saying. I think there's 12.
Are you including
I believe in Jefferson City, of course it's not a record, but I believe in Jefferson City that's not an uncommon issue.
But outside of Jefferson City, the number is about 12.
Okay.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Nine of them in this room?
But that's relevant to, wasn't there special expertise? Because there is a lot of litigation and it's very complex and our cases have not always been consistent on that issue of whether or not a case is intended to be contested or not, whether you're entitled to the full panoply of rights you get in a contested case.
Well, two things I need to say about it. First of all, I disagree that the matter of this being a contested case or not was hotly litigated. It was
raised.
It came
up here and went back down, right, on that issue?
It went to.
Or the Court of
It went, yes, ma'am. It went to the Court of Appeals and came back down on that issue. That's true. The other thing is that I'll have to disagree with Mr. Mullen, and I'm going to leave it to the court to review the record. The evidence was not that Mr. Springer ever had any difficulty finding an attorney to take this case. There's absolutely no evidence in the record of that. There's no evidence in the record that as a result of this particular issue, the contested matter, that Mr. Springer ever had any difficulty finding an attorney who could handle the case.
But was there any evidence that he could find? Was there any evidence put forward by the state that there were attorneys available at $75 an hour?
What? No, Your Honor, except that, let me make it clear, what we're doing is we're skipping a step.
Well, he puts Roger Brown on and says, now he may, one would say maybe he's self-interested because he's the lawyer, but he puts Roger Brown on, he's a different lawyer, and he says, no one would handle the case. Don't you, as good advocacy, wouldn't you need to, in a contested case, wouldn't you need to somehow rebut that and say, oh, here's a lawyer, he'll handle it for $75?
Well, no, Roger Brown's testimony dealt with the second part of the discussion, which is, what is a reasonable rate? Before we get to the reasonable rate, Mr. Springer had the obligation to prove a special factor.
So you're saying no one could meet the standard of proving they're entitled to more than $75 unless the person being represented was able to testify, I tried to get someone at 75, couldn't do it, tried at 85, couldn't do it, tried at 95, basically that kind of testimony?
No, ma'am. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that the burden is on the prevailing party. The individual who is trying to get their fees from the state, the burden is on them to prove a special factor. That may be one way of doing it.
But why, I think the question that some of the questions are coming to is, why doesn't it satisfy that if the record were to show that Mr. Brown and Mr. Moen said that no one would take this case at $75, that that's not reasonable, that it's too complex a case and no one will take it at that. Isn't that evidence?
No, two reasons. Number one is because if that's the case, and I'm assuming that's the case, I'm going to assume that there is nobody, as Mr. Moen said.
Okay.
Mr. Moen's a good attorney. He's been here a long time. He did a good job in this case. I'm assuming that he and Mr. Brown are absolutely accurate.
Okay.
There's no one in Jefferson City in private practice,
right,
who will
gotcha.
Will work for $75 an hour. The fallacy is
judges might, but that's
well. I've been here 30 years, and I don't think I'll ever see that rate. But that's either here nor there.
But the special factor would be that there are no lawyers. Wouldn't that conceivably be a special factor that the legislature said there should be attorneys? It should be $75 an hour. But a special factor might be there's no one qualified that will handle the case. That would seem to be a special factor.
See, we're not, Your Honor, but we're not, the evidence wasn't about qualifications. The evidence was that regardless of how good a lawyer you were in Jefferson City.
So tell me, and you didn't finish, $75, no one will work for it, but that's not enough because?
Because the other thing that we need to understand is the statute does not require any attorney to work for $75 an hour. The statute simply limits the amount of reimbursement that the individual will get from the state, which is a much different issue.
Well then why would there be any special factors? I mean, if that was it, why do you sometimes get more than $75 an hour if you prove a special factor?
Because if you prove that you have an area of expertise that is not generally available, that you need that this attorney was needed in the case. For example, in the Hutchings case, there was an individual, apparently it was the lawyer in that case was the only attorney who had expertise both in state and federal aspects of Medicaid law. And so that was the special factor in Hutchings.
What about this issue concerning reasonableness? Normally, when we're talking about medical bills or other types of construction bills, there's a presumption of reasonableness when the bills are paid. And in this case, you know, the evidence apparently is that he sent a bill and he paid it. So isn't there a presumption that bill was reasonable because the full amount was paid, as opposed to other cases where maybe it isn't paid?
There is no challenge. I am not challenging the reasonableness of the fee. And so to that extent that we've got laymen making that decision, I don't think that's really the issue. The issue is more basic than that, and it goes back to if we say that because no one makes $75 an hour in private practice, that's a special factor, well, then it's not.
Let me suggest something else, because the such as does leave it in kind of an open-ended situation. The legislature passed this law in 1989 when, as I recall, $75 an hour was a rate at which you could get an attorney. I was alive and well and aware of the practice of law at that time, and it was certainly, that was a deal. I don't know what the rate of inflation has done, but the legislature didn't build in a rate of inflation. They just said special factors such as, but it seems to me that would be one of the things that you might consider is what is the prevailing rate now. For example, I think since 1989, and I didn't check the Consumer Price Index, but it's available, but it's probably about $175 an hour in 1989 might be as much as $140 or $150 today. So if you just use that, you would certainly at least be pulling yourself off of the $75. And it seems to me that that might be a special factor. Now, 20 years after 1989, you could have had no inflation. We could have been blessed with zero inflation. So $75 equals $75. But $75 isn't what it used to be.
And that's great. And the legislature knows how to do that. The legislature has created a factoring in to increase, for example, the amount of the limits on sovereign immunity. But the legislature didn't do it in this case.
But here you're talking about professional fees, which don't always necessarily track inflation costs. And if you build in an inflation factor, you might be wary about doing that if you're a legislator, because you might be up to something like $300 an hour when the prevailing market is still somewhere around $175, because lawyers don't always necessarily adjust their rates. Sometimes they adjust them faster than the rate of inflation, and sometimes more slowly.
And again, the thing is, I think the legislature knows how to do that. And if they didn't do that, which I think is an indication that that's not what they intended to happen, it may be that $75 is inadequate reimbursement, but that is the level that the legislature set. And I do think that it is a matter of purely the legislature. Again, in the absence of this statute.
But it would be easier to agree with you, don't you think, if it just said $75 an hour, period, end of sentence.
It would make things simpler, but they've created this thing that they call special factors.
The statute refers to rates for witnesses as well as rates for attorneys. And it uses the language market rate when it's referring to the witness fees, but not when it's referring to attorney's fees. Should that be?
Absolutely. The express mention, rules of statutory interpretation, the express mention of one thing, we presume it intends to exclude everything else. And so I think there's, a presumption that was intentional by the legislature. We are not going by market rate.
And that brings me to the question I asked opposing counsel, which is, both briefs seem to assume either $75 or market rate, but it says special factors may make a higher fee appropriate. If this court were to disagree with you that we can't consider the unavailability of attorneys at $75, if we were to say that is a special factor, does that mean we automatically jump to market rate, or is there some other rate? And Judge Fisher made a very good point that we don't have a trial court here. We have a board of non-attorneys, so how do we figure what that is?
Well, and the reason the board has made a decision is because the Western District, when it sent it back down, says the board is the one who's supposed to make the decision, and that's what the statute says.
So what do they base the high? If in the case where there is a special factor, say it was a patent law case, which is an example given in the federal case, how would the court determine what the fee should be in where there's such a special factor?
Well, I do a lot of civil defense, and both in federal and state court, and what happens is that either through affidavits or through testimony, like in this case, lawyers come in and say, this is the prevailing rate, this is what a reasonable rate is. They make comparisons.
And so it suddenly jumps to reasonable prevailing rate as opposed to anything in between.
Right.
Why is that?
Well, that's the way it's done in the Missouri Human Rights Act as well. I'm a defense attorney, so it's hard for me to justify it, because people are getting reimbursed not for what they charge their client.
But in effect, we're assuming that if there's a special factor, then you jump to the prevailing rate, whatever it is, as opposed to...
I'm not presuming that. No, ma'am. I'm not presuming that.
What would it jump to if this court found you had to increase it? What are you saying?
I think that the board or the fact determiner, whoever has that authority, whether it's a trial court or the board, would have the authority to set what they believe to be a reasonable rate.
And what would they look at in figuring that?
Testimony or
the middle ground is what happens to the Equal Access to Justice Act under federal law, and I think we might have applied that in the McMahon case, in the Court of Appeals case, and say no, it's about attorney's fees, is that the $75 an hour, even in 89, was not the market rate. You'd find lawyers for that amount, but the Equal Access to Justice Act provided a CPI escalator. So whatever the fee was, whether it was $75, which, again, was not the market rate, even in 89, what generally the private practitioner would get.
With all due respect,
it would go up according to CPI year in and year out, and it's just, as Judge Wolf said, it might be 150, might be 200, but it's basically still the same amount of money, which is below the market rate.
And with all due respect, these are excellent suggestions and excellent ideas, but it is not within the prerogative of this court. The legislature knows these things, and the legislature has the authority to increase the rate and has chosen not to do so.
Mr. Bruce, let me ask you a question, because I think, too, this case ought to be based upon the statute. It specifically says, such as the limited availability of qualified attorneys for the proceedings involved. It doesn't say the specialty of an attorney. So why isn't the general unavailability a special factor to be considered? Because that's what the statute does say. It says the limited availability of qualified attorneys for the proceedings involved.
Because then, here in 2011, it is no longer a special factor.
Well, no, they get to decide what the special factors are, and they pick this one. And they even allowed courts with the such as clause to create more. But this is actually a special factor that they picked.
No, Your Honor, with all due respect, they did not pick it. Mr. Springer chose to argue that that was the special factor.
No, but the statute says a special factor such as limited availability. That's what Judge Fisher is saying. So I'm saying
the legislature served him a softball and said, here it is.
Well, and if we eviscerate the law, then we do exactly what the Supreme Court said shouldn't happen in Pierce.
But the word such as, as the judge said, such as means for example. Special factors such as, or for example, the unavailability of attorneys.
Okay. And again, the record, there's no evidence that no attorney was unwilling to take this case.
But isn't it then a special factor, though, when you use the words
and the
such
burden,
as?
Yes, sir. And the burden is on the petitioner, on Mr. Springer, to prove it. And he did not prove that.
Can you distinguish the Hutchison's case? Was that a case where there was evidence produced of that special factor?
Yes.
Or was there a more specialized, complicated proceeding? I don't know. What's the distinction?
Again, what the Court of Appeals said was that, that particular attorney, I can't remember the name, but was the only attorney in the St. Louis metropolitan area who had expertise in Medicaid law. They also, I think, talked about the fact that he had expertise both in experience both in federal and state court. The Douglas case that was cited by Mr. Springer, that was just a district court case, but this fellow, he spoke fluent Spanish. The individuals were from the Dominican Republic. It was an immigration case. He had an office in Dominican Republic. He had special expertise in immigration law. Lawyers take contingency cases all the time. Lawyers understand they may not always get reimbursed at the full amount. I do auto accidents. They take a contingency case, and they may not get reimbursement at all. When Mr. Moen took this case, he had no assurance that he was going to be the prevailing party, yet he was willing to take the case. I don't think that this statute inhibits the ability of individuals to receive representation. It simply limits the amount that the state will reimburse, and I think that's a legislative prerogative, and I think it should remain so. Thank you.
I agree with this court that the setting of an appropriate professional fee is a very complex thing, and it cannot be done on a black line rule. Lawyers charge different things in different parts of the states for different reasons, and I think the legislature intended for this board to not rely on that, but to search for a different standard. And the standard.
Well, don't you have some examples in federal court after Eckerhart versus Hensley? Was my case, Eckerhart versus Hensley, there's a Rodriguez case that came and set out like 8 or 10 factors on how you determine reasonable attorney's fees, which includes the complexity and the availability of attorneys. I mean, this is all very, there's a lot of law on this with the reasonable attorney's fee.
There is. It occurs in context other than the 536 regime, which spells out a fairly detailed way. The attorney presents an hourly statement. An hourly rate, itemized expenses, the complexity of the case or the importance of the issues involved are not included.
And where is that, in rule? I mean, it's not in the statute.
It's 536.087.
And where does that apply?
Pardon me?
That's used in what context?
It's used in this context. There's a whole regulatory scheme for how you do attorney's fees petitions, and it is not like under the Human Rights Act. It is not like under a discrimination case.
But it's not been applied here to this subset about 75. Does it say this is how you decide if there's a special factor?
No. Okay. That's 085.4, which we've been discussing. I'm just saying that there's this broader framework that sort of spells out how you're supposed to do this. And I think the way it's supposed to work is that, as far as a special factor, the claimant comes in, his attorney puts on evidence that nobody will take the case and he has some specialty, and then I think the board's people or the attorney general's office needs to come forward with somebody that will work for $75 an hour. Maybe there's somebody working out of their garage that'll do that.
Now, Mr. Mullen, when you take these kinds of cases, these employment termination cases, you explain to your client what your fee is, and representing them to get that decision reversed. If you aren't successful, that's the fee you get paid, or you hope to get paid. True?
True.
And if you are successful, I'm sure you explained this to your client on your initial consultation, that if you are successful and your client does get reinstated, you will ask the state to reimburse, but the statute says $75, unless there's a special factor. Is that true?
I try to remember to explain that. I remember in the hearing, Mr. Springer said he couldn't remember if I told him that or not. I think I did. I normally do, yes. That's the framework.
Don't you have a written agreement? Don't you have a written attorney's fee agreement as per the code of professional ethics?
I'm pretty sure I did. I don't remember putting it in evidence, but he initially hired me for $155 an hour.
For how much?
$155 an hour in 2005.
But he didn't give you a retainer or anything. You have to...
I don't recall whether he gave me an initial amount of money that I worked down from up front or not. I think he just paid me hourly. I think he paid for an initial consultation and then paid hourly, as I recall.
You haven't responded to Mr. Bruce's argument that the statute, the way it's written, doesn't indicate that the award of attorney's fees should be all of the attorney's fees required to be paid, that the legislature appears from the statute to simply have set an amount that could be a partial reimbursement of attorney's fees in a more limited amount, as opposed to the market rate, which is the language used for witnesses.
I would agree with you if the statute didn't say unless you have factors such as the limited availability. I think the legislature wrote in that there would be flexibility in this award. If they didn't want flexibility, they should have just said $75 an hour, that's it.
But if the limited availability because of the expertise required an attorney that charges $400, the statute could still be read as allowing reimbursement for $200 rather than $400, could it not?
It could. That's correct. I think that flexibility is there. I think courts are directed to look at what is the minimum amount necessary to obtain representation in this case. That's what I think their meaning. Didn't really say it.
One quick thing. I know they remanded the case to the board to make this determination. The statute says unless the court determines that there's a special factor. Is that because the statute's generic to whoever's making it, or is there some role for the court, as in the circuit court, or somebody, this court,
well,
to make that determination?
Yeah, there's other places in 536 where it talks about the board making a determination on fees, having a hearing. Yeah. And the court and board are kind of used interchangeably in there. The complexity of lay people deciding what a reasonable attorney fee is still an issue. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is taken under submission. The court will